The presentation that I will do this evening is sort of a condensed single version of a class that I taught this past winter in spring semester at Montana State, and it was a Current Issues in Science, a one-credit class offered through the Earth Sciences Department, and this is our Earth, and we are incredibly fortunate to have Montana State University as part of our community in terms of being a flywheel for innovation, education, knowledge, everything that goes with a university like that. We're always thankful for them and for, on my own end, to embark on a quest for knowledge and work on studying what we'll be talking about tonight, which is glaciers and climate change and within the geography department. And hopefully, if I unplug the lazy button and don't go climbing as much, I might finish up some work and get a master's in earth sciences and specifically climate change. So, as Horatio mentioned, Jennifer is in the audience tonight, my wife. Thank you so much, Janae, for being here. And we had our three boys for a period of 8 years and at Headwaters, so we were there with all the bake sales and doing things. And in the course of it, I was out climbing expeditions and doing these sort of things. And this is the Meru climb. It was one that we started out in 2003, finished in 2011. Wasn't there the whole time, but three trips over that period of that eight-year period. And then Jimmy and Renan pulled together and made a film titled Meru. And this is the three of us on the summit. It's out on Netflix. So if you've had a chance to see it, thank you so much. And we've had great support from the Bozeman community and with that. So thank you. It was it's humbling now that it's on Netflix. Jenny and I, people reach out to us on a almost daily saying, this is wonderful. I saw the film and it gives me hope, and it's something other than what we're going on with it on that. So tonight we're a couple things. I'll be speaking about glaciers and what they are and sort of the science aspect of it. So the students that are in the audience tonight, this is something you can take home and learn from. And then also where we are as humans and what we're doing to this planet and some of the challenges that we're facing here. So, it didn't like form up that way. This is what computers can do. And I didn't do it. I'm thankful for the people at 350.org for helping me out with this this information. But since the advent of the Industrial Revolution, which 1760, 1780 is the generally accepted time when we started burning, going from wood to coal in terms of getting things, and then the acceleration of that. And the effect of it is what we have here, the CO2 particulates in the atmosphere. And so this is from NASA, and they measure this at Mauna Kea. We can see the hockey stick. We have accurate climate understanding going back 600,000 years, and I'll explain how we do that as scientists. But here we are now, and this where we are with over 400 parts per million of CO2. And it's pretty serious stuff. And this graphic here, we'll take a look at it. So this is 1880. 1880, 1850 is about the start of when humans accurately were able to measure the environment. And we had weather stations. Montana here in the Gallatin Valley had one in there. So this we can track through this and watch the calendar up on the top there, turn of the century. We're going to go into World War I. We fought a bunch, came back, the Roaring 90s, stock market fall, Hitler comes to power, 39, World War II, 45, end of World War II. So we're moving up now for the baby boomers. I was born. Many of you were born there, but look at how this changes. And these are where we look at. Obviously, the yellow and red equals warmer. This is now 20 years ago, 10 years, 18 years ago, and take a look at where we are now. And this is one of these ways that we can use information to understand what our climate is doing and our effect on it. And it's as a scientist, as a layperson scientist, and the scientists that we have in the audience, you understand a lot of what these are. But we have ways that this that warming climate, we started out with the CO2 being up in over 400. We saw how the planet is on average warmer since 1880, and now this is an effect of what is going on. So this is the pack ice, and so the left graph coming down there is the annual, the maximum extent, minimal extent, so it goes through the years. We're going back about 30 years, and you can see the decrease on this, and it's pretty shocking, and to eventually see that there will be no polar ice cap there, and the Northwest Passage, which would come up between Baffin Island and Greenland and go through to the northern part of Alaska, would be gone. And it's predicted that the remainder. Oh, here's the mouse! Yay! This is going to be the only ice left. Is going to be bunched up on the northern edge of Greenland after the entire sea ice melts out, and that's seasonal ice. And then we move down to Antarctica, which is at the southern hemisphere. And this is again another infographic of where we are with temperatures and how those are changing with that. And so, looking at ice mass and where it is, and if you can see this from back there, you'll see little what look like veins on a leaf on there. And then these are, we can see how fast the ice is moving. And we're looking at how much ice is being lost off of Antarctica. And this is straightforward observational science. And we're getting really good at this as humans. I mean, our mobile phone here, you can put it in your pocket and it'll tell you how far you've hiked. You can put on a Strava type thing. It'll tell you where you've run, what elevation. And so we're getting really good with sensors. I mean, they're the size of a candy bar, and we're putting them everywhere, and they're getting real-time feedback on that. So a lot of these things that we're seeing in here that we might not necessarily see are they're affecting us. And the importance of Antarctica in terms of it being a continent is cannot be understated. So the students here in the classroom, it's the fifth largest continent. 98 of it is covered in ice. 70% of the world fresh water is close to 2 kilometers thick in ice. Coldest, driest, windiest, and highest continent on average. And it's a desert with 200 millimeters of annual precipitation. So, but what does Antarctica do for us? And so the cold water that comes off of Antarctica, as it melts, it is fresh water, cold sinks, whether it's cold air, cold water. And it's basically the engine that drives the global currents as it comes off, and then providing fresh water into them, affecting in the northern hemisphere, the Gulf Stream, and then the circumpolar currents that happen in Antarctica. Really important things. It was first visited by Roald Amundsen, pictured there on the left, a Norwegian explorer. And it was sort of the golden age of exploration, where we went from exploring places to understand about them for wealth and conquest and colonialism, things like that, to kind of be there and aspirational. They were there a month earlier than Shackleton, Scott and his team. Shackleton was there 2 years prior. Previous turn back because he didn't have enough endurance to get there and back. And then here we have Scott and his team getting to the South Pole and being like, oh, we weren't there first. And this is before the age of satellite phones. These guys were really off the map, and all the men perished on their way back. But Antarctica is a place that I am fascinated with and have had the good fortune to visit, and this was from a recent expedition that Horatio mentioned, traveling to Queen Maud Land, where I had visited in 1996-97 with Alex Lowe of Bozeman when we were there. So some of the things that about the Antarctica, it's basically one massive flat glacier, and the peaks that we see here are nunataks, which are bits of rock that pop out of them. And so a lot of what we look to understand in climate modeling is the energy balance. And so how much ice is are we getting? How much are we losing? And obviously, if I wanted to be narrow-minded and myopic, I would look outside and be like, well, it snowed 20 centimeters on the 2nd of April. Climate change is not real. Let's throw snowballs. And this is my proof of it. But a lot of this is the phase change of how things are. So we're storing this energy up in terms of a CO2 increasing, but the time it takes for the ice to melt is not immediate. And this is pretty obvious too. I mean, you put your ice cube in your glass of water and it doesn't melt immediately. It takes time. And so as things build up on it and they're compounded by positive feedback loops till you hit a tipping point, and then all of a sudden you've got a real challenge on there, and trying to understand that that what's going on there. So for the Headwater students, you'll this will be on your quiz on Friday, the albedo. So this is something we can learn about. And if we look outside right now, the entire valley all the way down to Jackson and further south is covered with snow, and that's reflecting sunlight back out, and it's keeping it colder. So we've had an abnormally cold, wet winter here, which is great for skiers and climbers and things like that. But what we're looking at is trying to understand that. So snow has a high albedo. It reflects light back up, but coal, being very dark and mass-absorbing, would heat up. And this is obvious. You look at your – if you have a black lab and he's laying on the sidewalk in the middle of summer, you feel how warm he is. And so this is sort of the basis of how we're working on these things. So, but the mass balance is for glaciologists, and people are studying it, how much snow is replenished, how rapidly is it melting off, and what are the what is that balance in there, and trying to understand that both in the present and in the previous. And the way we look at it in the previous is with paleoclimatology. So success for tonight's slideshow would be if one of the students became a paleoclimatologist. It's one of the coolest things out there. So, I mean, just look at this. You have 18 subsets to study in paleoclimatology. And so whether it's forcing on the sun, fire history on tree rings, fauna, which would be mammoths in Siberia, pollen down below, plant macros, ice cores, historical. I mean, all these great ways to look at it and understand what is going on with our climate. And glaciology taps back into that. So I'll switch over to the Himalaya. So if you are in Nepal, you would call it Himalaya. In the United States, we have this way of using the vowel A in two different pronunciations. So we'd say Himalaya. So chew on that one for if you're a linguistic, but we'll call it Himalaya for the people that are there. And this fascinating image taken from the space shuttle, looking out, and it's circling the planet there, and we can see to the left in the green, the verdant plain of the Ganga River and Indian subcontinent, the Himalayas jutting up, and then over to the right, the Tibetan plateau and the effect of that. And this is a result of the of plate tectonics. So the Himalayas basically are the crest of that curve there, and the Indian subcontinent is moving northward into the Asian landmass through plate tectonics at the speed our fingernails grow. So that's pretty fast. That's pretty much supersonic speed. And it's subducting, which means it's being pushed underneath. And it doesn't necessarily go back up in the mountains, but it's more of it's wrinkling it up and elevating the Tibetan plateau. And then within that, five of the world's great rivers are within that area there. And it provide a source of sustenance and water livability for approximately 20% of the world's population. So if you think about that, what's going on there, this is certainly a place to learn about these things. There's over 8,000 glaciers, the five major rivers that we're talking about, and then the world's population there. And I didn't come to my fascination with Himalayan glaciers by being a glaciologist. I wanted to go out there and go climbing, which is sort of my way of riding roller coasters. It's fun. I guess somewhat everyone has. Licorice isn't for everyone, but this is what I like to do and climb mountains. And so, but seeing how these places are changing, and then also that that how that combines with the people there and what we're able to do with it. And it's a very key place. The high altitude and high latitude areas are seeing the effects of climate change on a more rapid basis than the than places that are more temperate. So obviously, if you're in Florida and the New York, Holland, London, the rise of the sea level is going to be an imminent threat. But what might be triggering that is the loss of the frozen ice, high latitude being the polar areas, and then high altitude being what we have here in the Himalayas and also here in Montana. And the challenge with the Himalayas is it runs between 27 degrees north latitude up to about 35 degrees. So we're at 45 and change here. You're aware of that every time you drive up to Mammoth and you pass the 45th latitude. Is like a little point. You're halfway to the pole. I kind of like that. But this is a very equatorial place. And so these glaciers that the change in the mass balance is really affecting them. And the way that we look at this is the historical repeat photography. So I'll show you some of this. Some of the first adventurers and explorers into the Himalayas, Vittorio Sella and the Archbishop Duke of Abruzzi from Italy, they were the first ones to travel to the Himalayas, the Karakoram, take pictures, and then we now come back and we walk around, put our cameras in the same spot, and you take a picture of it. And so it's sort of like that thing you have at home in the kitchen with your kids' heights on it. We're doing the same thing. Time-lapse photography, and this is a really nice way that we can take technology. I mean, you can run a time-lapse on your phone. It's built into it now. But we can then store an incredible amount of data on the cameras, have them charged by the sun, and they come out with it. So physical observation. So this is going in there and studying that Landsat imagery, which is using radar and LIDAR to see how the glaciers are changing. And then Google Earth, which is a really handy application on there. You can see a lot of different things on there. So I had talked about the low latitude, high altitude component about that. And one of the challenges with the Himalayas is we have the greatest accumulation time and the greatest melting time. So if you are in Alaska and it's wet and it's cold, say on Denali, you'll get meters and meters of snow that just accumulate quite a bit. And then they'll melt slowly in the summertime. But the Himalayas are affected by the monsoon, which is moisture that's coming out of the Indian Ocean and either onto the east side or the west side of the Indian subcontinent, and then moves up and releases the moisture onto the Himalayan mountain range. And this occurs in the summer, which is basically September through June. So it's a challenge because you have the simultaneously the greatest moment of melting and the greatest moment of accumulation. So that Fearn line, which is in where the snow accumulates above it and where it melts below, that level, as we learn more about it and we study it, is really key to the health of glaciers in the Himalayas. So wind transport, we all understand that. That's why Bridger Bowl is on that side of the mountain, the east side of the mountain, and the west side of the mountain. So a lot of these things are there in checking out the mountain. The monsoon and the jet stream. The jet stream comes in the wintertime, and it just is scours the peaks there that are over 8,000-meter peaks of all the snow. You can just imagine the strength of that. So, but the glaciers accepting the Biafo and the Snow Lake Glacier and the northern Karakoram in the Himalayas are they're by and large formed by avalanches. So this is the Ogre and Latok II, and these are prime examples of why the Himalayas is this giant snow fence that is a result of plate tectonics. And the scale that we see there is 7,000 feet. So that's more than double the size of what we see at Big Sky from the very bottom up to the top of Lone Peak. And it's an absolute cliff. And so how do the glaciers form? We can see where they are down there, and they form as a result of avalanches. And this is they're nice to look at, but knowing firsthand the effect of it, and for Jenny and I and our family with the loss of Alex through a steep avalanche in that case was really an indication of it. So we can see how they come down, and then they fill in the lower flat bases in there. So this accumulates snow, and then it triggers and it avalanches down. And it's a standard geologic process that goes on over time. So switching now on to photographs, this is the main fork of the Rongbuk Glacier. This is East Fork of the Rongbuk, comes up over here. This is the path up to the north ridge of Everest. But we see here this lower tongue of the glacier and how much the rock cover is on there that insulates it, but that can also accelerate it. And if we go on to here on our next image, these are from the Rongbuk Glacier. On the left, we see the initial photographs that were taken in 1924 by Mallory, and then repeat photographs taken by Dave Brashears on this on the ice vision. So if we look here, this is what it looked like in 24. We can see where the elevation of the ice is, and then we dissolve through to where we are now, and it's shocking how much it's released down. And so the penitentes, these ice towers, are a normal function at a glacier that is a result of the sun and the melting of it. And as those towers march up the glacier, we have an idea of how the overall health of it. And so when you climb on these, you can kind of understand where that ice was and how old it is and the timeliness of it. So the north side of Mount Everest, the apex of our planet, and the central Rongbuk Glacier there coming out. And it's really intense mountainscapes in the Himalaya. So if you're a fan of the mountains, it's certainly worth looking into. And so here, again, this is Everest is on the far left. And then looking over to the north side of Pumori, this was first visited in 24 by the pioneering English expeditions led by George Mallory. And again, the repeat photography by the Iceworks expeditions. And so we come in here and we take a look at the top, and we can see the lateral and the medial moraines. Those are the rocks that are pulled through there, and then where it is now, and just how fast that has dropped out of there. Another example here, this is a rock that has formed, and you can look on these and you can identify certain features. So just coming off the top of this, what taken at the same time of the year, so part of historical repeat photography is that if the photo was taken on the 8th of June, you want to be there on the 8th of June. There will be seasonal variation with it, but you're not going to go there in late August after the monsoon has had a lot of snow. But we can see that snow patch is completely gone. And then looking in here at where that level of snow and ice was in the 1920s, and then where we are now. And it's one of these great things that we look at this as, oh, it's art, it's photography, it's a hobby, it's something you might want to do. But we now understand from a GIS, geographical information system standpoint, that photographs are data. And then we can then look at them and we can pinpoint the health of glaciers and things. So again, looking off towards Everest, Everest over here on the right, and we can see the early picture, and then later on, just the size of the moraine, these glaciers that were hanging up over here, these are no longer connecting and adding ice into that. So it's pretty dire stuff, and I'm sharing these with you because we have we're like to understand the Himalayas, and that's where I'm at with it. But we also have the what's going on in Glacier National Park, and that the prediction of when glaciers will be no longer there and they're melting out to become a permanent snowfield. We make these predictions, and then 20 years pass by, and we were too optimistic in the rate of glacial ice preservation, and they end up melting faster. So a lot of these things are really the writing on the wall. And so that's my responsibility as a mountain climber. And here's like one of the silliest pun jokes you've ever heard. And I originally got it from Bazooka Gum. Remember they had the cartoons inside? And this one came out and it was like these horrendous pink bricks. And if they were stale, they'd break your teeth. But if they were fresh, you'd like, I got fresh bazooka and you'd blow. And this one came out and it said, how do mountains hear? And it said with mountaineers. And I want to find that again. But I am the eyes and the ears of the mountains. And so looking here at the, this is the North Ridge, the Northeast Ridge, and the standard route on the north side of Mount Everest. Photograph taken in 1924 on the top, and then this is probably in 2010 below. And as ice decreases in mass, it becomes more glaciated. It moves at a more rapid pace. And then you have positive feedback loops. So Changtse is the peak on the right. And as that loses the ice on there, you can see how much more rock is exposed there. That then melts more, and it is a positive feedback loop. And a lot of these things in glaciology and like, oh, it moves slow, it moves like a glacier, it's no big deal. But where we are in Bozeman, we understand what ice is. And if you're out there on a warm day and you can scrape the ice out from underneath your driveway because there's a little film of water in there, it makes it easy. But then also tomorrow or the next day the sun comes out, we're going to see this snow melt incredibly fast. And ice and snow gets to these tipping points where they then go with it. This is Janu and Kanchenjunga, which is on the eastern edge of the Himalayas. So one of the beautiful things from a Earth sciences standpoint is that the third highest peak is in the eastern part of the Himalayas. The highest peak, Everest, is in the central part of the Himalayas, and the second tallest peak, K2, is in the western Himalayas in the Karakoram subrange within the Himalayas. Himalaya, we'll get it right. But we can see that that how everything is changing there, going back and forth. These were the initial photographs were taken by Duke of Abruzzi and Sella. So really fascinating, if you like, geology. And look at that. There is no more glacier in there. And so the same effects that we see happening here in the Himalayas are also taking place in the Alps on a regular basis. In 2010, I worked with Jim Balog in the Extreme Ice Survey. And these are the time-lapse cameras that we set up and were there. So this is the Nare Glacier. This is a photograph that was taken by Barry Bishop, Lila Bishop's late husband. And so the Nare Glacier, we'll look down here on this part of the ice there. And then this is approximately the same place. And we can see how much further up it's pulled out from it. A picture of the main fork of the Khumbu Glacier, Everest. This is the south side that people climb on. This is a photograph taken by Norman Dianforth from this 1963 expedition. And then this is more recently. We can see a lot of these tongues of glacier that come down off of Nupse are gone. The hanging ice that's over on the other side are gone. So here's an example. This is April 7th to February 10, 2010. So this is 11 years ago, and a time-lapse photography of a glacier in Iceland. And so part of this was that the volcano that came and put the ice, covered the ice with volcanic ash. So the albedo effect was lower, so there was more energy absorbed to it. And we can see how it's melting. And look at the terminal moraine there as it's going. And the beauty of this, in sort of in an obscure way that's going in reverse right now, is that anyone can understand this. We have been in Kilimanjaro working with people that are climbing on the mountain, the porters and the guides that we work with, Tanzanian people, and we might not be able to communicate what's going on with atmospheric CO2 and the challenges and mass balances, some of these things I talked about there. But this is like watching an ice cream melt on your porch. And so this is kind of one of my happy places, being like technology nerd in the outdoors on a cliff. So everything all in one. So this was the camera station that we set up, and the this is Everest Base Camp down below with all the tents and where people are starting to head up there to go climb on the mountains at this point. And so a weatherproof box mounted up, climbing hardware, and then a solar panel, a small computer that then adjusts the aperture. And then this is the net result. So this is the main icefall coming through, and we can see it moving as it picks up speed here. We'll kind of see how that comes through there. And this is fascinating. I'll sit and watch this. I mean, this one clip I've probably watched numerous times, and I'll put my cursor over some point. And what I look at is the high angle cryosphere over here on the right. And so those features are what we climb on. So from an intuitive place, I want to understand what this ice is doing. Is it safe to climb there? Would I be able to climb through it? Would it be fun climbing? Is it dangerous climbing? Those sort of things. But there's also more information in there on how it's going. And so the same camera mount that we had looking up the Khumbu Icefall, this is the most dangerous and treacherous part of climbing Everest, is going through this. It's completely not a place where humans are meant to be. So, and Jenny, you have my word, I will not climb through this again. This thing moves about a meter a day, and it's 450 meters elevation top to bottom. So we're looking at about 2,000 to 3,000 feet elevation gain, and it's just moving incredibly fast. And where it's broken up is where the ice is going with it, but then it where it's filled in is a result of avalanches coming in off either side of it. So it's really, if you look over here, looks like it'd be good skiing and be smooth hiking, but that is a result of the of avalanches coming down on it. So the summit of Everest, Makalu, fifth highest peak, Kanchenjunga on the far horizon, Lhotse, Nupse, the Everest Horseshoe, a really beautiful place in there. Amida Blam, which is another mountain. I mean, you look at them and they look anemic. The ice is melting off. There's not this this health to the ice. And then you see the dirt on it, and that dirt then absorbs more sun, and it becomes a positive feedback loop within that. And so what do these positive feedback loops create? And there's these are clips from Hurricane Sandy. We had Maria and a whole host of them this past summer, and we can expect more of them to come in here. And the cost of these environmental these superstorms that are coming, and they're going to be more frequent. And it took quite a bit of time for New England to recover from this, but places like Puerto Rico are still suffering. They massive effect on their economy and everything that's there. And we can be like, oh, we're fine. We live in Bozeman, Montana. We've got fresh water. All the water goes downstream. It eventually gets to New Orleans. We can go skiing. We can go climbing. But from a personal standpoint, we have the most innovative, curious, the most advanced education system in the world. And 8 out of the 10 top universities are in the United States. And this is by looking at patents awarded and PhDs awarded and innovative thinking that comes out of them. And this is what we as a nation are good. We go to the moon. We find problems. We're curious. We're team builders. We've worked with that. And that's something that, as a kid, I was born up. I was born into this, and I was our culture and our society. My parents, my mentors were all like, there's a responsibility that comes to being an American. And this is, for my generation, proximal to the Second World War, the rebuilding of Europe and Asia, what the America did with the Marshall Plan, and how that has affected that. There was a certain sense of responsibility to that. But not everything goes as you plan it to go, right? Like sometimes you fall when you're climbing. Stuff happens. And then this happened. So, and it's, I don't mean to be political about this, but I'm just being very factual. We have someone that is a climate denier in charge of the Environmental Protection Agency. We have a Secretary of Interior that came from Montana and was focused on, you know, anthropogenic climate change was real and public lands, but he's gone off on other things. So it's a pretty intense thing, and it's a very polarizing subject. And it's one that I'm not out here to make it more polarized. The way to get through conflict is with good communication and understanding the other person's point on how it is. But a lot of it is based on what we look at and how we address this thing. So it's a war on coal. It's a hoax, and we need to slash emissions. A lot of these things, they're very aggressive, and our planet isn't a very aggressive place. It's a very natural, breathing, continually evolving Earth system that we need to understand, because it is the basis of our existence. So if we don't take care of the planet with the water, the air, and the sustenance that we get from it, we're not going to be doing humanity a good thing. So this is an advertisement. 1962, the year I was born. Each day, Humboldt supplies enough energy to melt 7 million tons of glacier! Exclamation point. So this is Humboldt and Enco. It's probably been bought out by another. But there it is. I mean, this is the Taku Glacier. They've done historical repeat photography on this advertisement, and it's not even in there. And so they thought it was something to be totally psyched about, that they get enough petroleum there. And now we look at how we're looking at this. This is some information on the coal website. So from these are their time for a hot cold cappuccino, the coal hard facts, coal-powered SUV. A lot of this is challenging, because we do need job security, we need health, we need things. And here in the state of Montana, with Colstrip, there's a very real present challenge with that. And where we might be like, well, we're in Bozeman, we've got lights on, my computer's running, we're consuming energy. A portion of that energy does come from coal-fired electrical plants in Colstrip. As coal changes in the mix of energy, and the energy generation plants in Colstrip have timed out of their usable life, and they will not be put back online, the town of Colstrip, which has a population of 6,000, is now looking at a population of 2,000. And when you think about it in that sense, it's not like, oh, I want to be an adversary, and they're like, coal is great, and everything like that. I have empathy. How are they going to adjust to this? What are the jobs, the families, the people that are part of that? Because they have the same goals and aspirations that all of us do. And that's kind of the way that I try to look at these things and to get a better understanding with them. So the couple of the things. One of the adaptation and opportunity, so I can either be a pessimist and put my head in the sand and be like, okay, I'm going to live out, I'm 55, if I get another 40 years, 20 years or whatever, it's going to be plenty of carbon, it's going to be no big deal. But if you look at life through the prism of what are we doing for future generations, and Chief Seattle, the founder of the Siwash Indians in the Pacific Northwest, where Seattle and Amazon and Microsoft are all headquartered there, and his thoughts that have been adapted over time was that we need to be there for thinking about the next seven generations over a 200-year period. And so this is a book, The Drawdown. It's a fascinating book. It's Paul Hawken is a scientist and a collaborator with a lot of people, and in it he looks at hard science and ways that we can reduce carbon emissions. And Penguin, this book is $22. It's sold at it's a great value for what it is. If Headwaters doesn't have a copy in the library, this one's going home with the teachers tonight. But it's really great to look into it and to see these things. And what we have in here is solutions by rank. And so they've drilled down with hard science and analytics on this, looking at it. And one of the best ways that we can reduce carbon in the atmosphere and reduce this global warming and make get things better is the top of it is refrigeration management, and that the off-gassing, and if we forget to upcycle, repurpose the coolants that are in our cooling systems, they have a very volatile and a very toxic, very potent effect on climate. And so addressing that will, you know, what it will cost, how much it'll reduce, and then the cost savings in billions of dollars. And so it's really wind turbines, reduced food waste, a plant-rich diet, tropical forests, educating girls and family planning. I mean, think about that. There we are. We're not just looking at science, like let's put windmills up and tide things and solar panels, but this is how we change people. So eating less protein-based food and educating girls and family planning that allows people to have families at an older age to be more mindful of their offspring and how and what kind of a world they're bringing them into and sort of being with that. And so there's it's a great read. And whenever I'm bored, it's a great procrastination tool. You can flip it open and be like, it's like reading a magazine with cool stuff in it. And so I'm always about that sort of stuff. But there's also neat things. I mean, this is in Ladakh, which is in India, but it is culturally Tibetan. It was not overrun by the Cultural Revolution and the Maoists of China. And so they've been able to keep that in there. And this monk, they were like make a little hockey rink and they would go skating on it. And that was kind of what they had going with it. And they learned from that. And then they came out to where they create these ice stupas. So what you see underneath there, this is a flagpole where they put prayer flags and they farm ice on it and the size of the people in there. And then this ice is slowly released back into it. So the same way in that if you've been up Highlight Canyon or in the Bridgers, the amount of snow that we have in there this April at the maximum extent of it and before it starts melting away is what provides sustenance to our agriculture and the water that we have in there. So a lot of these are pretty simple sort of can-do things. And people are innovative. When you're forced into a situation, you don't have a way to get out of it, you come up with innovative ideas. And so when we look at it and we combine what we're, you know, how these facts that are in there, how do we work with this? And the one that scares me is that we're using up energy at a far greater rate than what we're able to bring out from the planet. And especially for us in the United States and Europe and parts of Asia, where we have a very advanced energy-intensive lifestyle, we're borrowing from future generations. And again, that comes back to where we need to be as responsible citizens to our community, our state, our nation, our planet, and for future generations, and really get behind science and technology. And where else than the Land-Grant University, Montana State, which is good stuff. And I'm an optimist. We will make this happen. We went to the moon July 20th, 1969. That was like the coolest thing. I was 7 or 8 years old, but I'm sure some of our friends, Tim, here, you're probably... What were you doing on when we landed on the moon, Tim?
I was drinking beer with my brother in Dubuque, Iowa.
There we go. Drinking beer with his brother in Dubuque, Iowa. Tim was the first headmaster of Headwaters for 4 years, and so a great guy and colleague and mentor in our community here. But yeah, and it's for me, it's selfish. I like to go adventure and travel in the mountains and do wild and crazy things, which is really we all have to have something that drives us and it gives us passion. And again, like licorice, it's not for everyone, but whatever you have something in your life that you're passionate about, that you want to get up and make the most of it on any given day. And for me, that make the most of it on any given day is rooted in my family. And that is connected to this gentleman, Alex Lowe. This was probably 25, 30 years ago. I had more hair. And Alex climbing. Alex climbing without a helmet. We wear helmets now. Alex working out. We didn't have good weather, so we worked out for a month at base camp. I came back really fit, but no summit. But hey, that's what you do. A lot of these journeys that we've gone on and explored places to be in Antarctica, time with your friends that that you're with, John and I in Antarctica. But my life on the 5th of October, 1999, and is a date that is where it was a change. This is the south face of Shishapongma, and I was on an expedition. And David Bridges, the cameraman, and Alex Lowe and I were swept away by an avalanche, and it took the life of David and Alex. And it came back to this question of that I face every time, and that is this quote by Albert Camus: whether or not one can live with one's passion and accept its law, which is to burn the heart it simultaneously exalts, that is the question. So we do what we do, but we know that it can also be extremely dangerous with it, and kind of finding that balance of being able to do something with that. And for Jennifer, Max, Sam, after the loss of Alex, we grew in love. Climbers aren't really fond of falling. It's like accountants don't like red ink. And we started our family, and it was in the course of this that what we had gone through with our family and the loss in the mountains from earth processes, avalanches, we realized that for the Sherpa community, there wasn't any family that had not experienced that level of loss of someone that had been had lost their lives, these elders of the village of Fortse. And so everyone within their community had, to some degree, first or second or third removed, had experienced death because they were in the mountains and they're dangerous places, and they were being asked to go there by visitors coming in there. So understanding that recreation, mountain tourism, I think is an inherently good thing. It's a great way to interact with other cultures, a great way to take the money that we have accumulated in the West and give it to people. We're giving them our money. They're giving us services. It's kind of a great way of moving wealth around without just putting it in a bank or having it go into military or into other places like that. And to realize that to make it better and to have less fatalities, that it might be good to have vocational training. And so this was the idea that Jenny came up with the Kumbu Climbing Center. Here, learning how to care for a patient with improvised material, using camping mattresses and a tarp and rope to make a litter, and then climbing on frozen waterfalls, which is what we do around here. It's a great way to practice your skills and refine them in a very steep environment that's controllable, and then you take it up into the mountains. But the effect of this, the work that has been done and the people that we've been with and all of that is profound, and that I guess eventually we get to a point in our life where it's not about us and how much can we take for ourselves, but how much can we give back to the other people? And that is, if you measure that as your success, then my own hunch is that that's kind of tied into happiness. So should we go with that?